This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is the Green New Deal possible? Can we really keep growing without wrecking more of the ecosphere? What is the addictive need to always promise people more? Why not live a simpler, happier way of life? Dr. Ted Trainer has led that exploration. Ted is an independent scholar based in Sydney, Australia. He retired as lecturer at the School of Social Work, University of New South Wales. Trainer published numerous books and articles on personal sustainability and community building, including Pig Face Point, an alternative lifestyle education site near Sydney. He has published on the Green New Deal as well. Ted Trainer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Ted, we're going to give the listeners a four-step process here. First, we need your assessment of where we are now. Then I have questions about your 2022 technique critique of the Green New Deal. So as a start, most of our listeners are driving around in gas cars. They fly sometimes. They buy lots of stuff. And meanwhile, billions of people in less developed countries see that wonderful life in advertisements and movies and TV. They want the same. They want it quickly, even during this time of crises. Ted, how do you see the situation we are in now?
Well, it's grossly unsustainable, the way of life we have. And, of course, you just described the way of life that maybe a billion or 2 billion people have. And even they are stressed and many of them struggling. But the possibility of extending that way of life to the 10 billion we'll have soon is totally impossible. No chance whatsoever. One of my papers details a numerical argument that looks at the estimates of resources available and so on and concludes that we have a per capita resource consumption rate in rich countries that is probably around 10 times the consumption rate that all the world's people could sustainably rise to. Now, most people have no idea about that, but most people know we've got terrible problems. Ecological resource, conflict over resources, third world being deprived, etc. But they don't understand just how far beyond sustainable and just ways our lifestyles in rich countries are. Now, if you accept that, or if you find the numerical arguments, which are not just put forward by me, of course, if you find those arguments plausible, you have no alternative but to face up to dramatic reductions in our consumption rates. And luckily now there is a growing, rapidly growing degrowth movement worldwide. In other words, people are starting to realise what I've just said is valid and starting to grapple with how the devil can we transition to better ways. Very central in the predicament is the kind of economy we've got. It is, of course, an economy that must grow. It cannot even stand still because that means recession, bankruptcies, unemployment and so on, let alone could it face up to dramatic reductions in the amount of producing and consuming going on. So what we're faced with here is system change of an enormous kind as distinct from or in addition to changes in lifestyles. We can't solve these problems just by trying to cut our, our driving and our luxury tourism and so on. We have to make enormous changes in the kind of systems we have, and the economic system is one of the, is perhaps the most important. But also, which was something that must change pretty obviously, is our value system, our culture. We are not going to move at all in the right direction till people realise that the pursuit of affluence and growth and wealth and property is a dreadful mistake. It's not just impossible. It's not just absurd. It's now suicidal because that whole syndrome is what's generating the big global problems that look like they'll bring us down very, very shortly.
Well, on the economy, no one gets elected promising people they must live with less. Instead, from Europe to Korea, the Green New Deal is popular because it promises growth without the sin. In May 2022, you published a paper, A Technical Critique of the Green New Deal. What is your critique, Ted Trainer?
There is no possibility whatsoever of solving the big global problems and our own problems, like wrecking the environment, unless we degrow enormously. So it all goes back to that basic argument, and you have got to look at that carefully and decide whether it's valid or not. Now, there's a lot of people, not just me, who are publishing heavy academic papers saying that it is valid. We cannot have growth and solve the problems. The basic assumption in that version of the Green New Deal, which assumes that growth is possible, is a decoupling faith. The view, the assumption that we can separate growth in output, wealth and all that from the amount of resources being used and the environmental damage that's going on. Now, that assumption is totally false. And there is now a very heavy literature showing that you can decouple in particular areas, like you can produce carpets with less waste than you used to. But the overall issue is what matters, and that is whether GDP, the total amount of producing and consuming going on, can continue to go up while we bring those resource and environmental impacts not just down, but down enormously. The World Wildlife Fund has been telling us for years that we're using nearly twice as many resources as is sustainable. Now, if you draw a graph of this, you have GDP to 2050 almost trebling, going up and up. And do you think you can take the resource use point on that graph that we presently have down to half its size, half its height, while that GDP goes up? It's just absurd. And we've got lots of heavy papers. There's one that has looked at 800 studies and concludes that decoupling is not being achieved and it is not remotely likely to be achieved. So the GND is really a stab in the dark estimate. Gesture of face, just saying, we technical advance can do it. You know, we'll be right. We don't have to change our lifestyles. We don't have to change our economy. Well, my article is trying to summarise the scientific technical reasons why that faith is not just utterly mistaken, but an act of bad faith. It's dishonest. Now, if you look at the evidence, the science, and all the papers coming out, you realise you cannot hold that faith. And that means that you have to face up to transitioning lifestyles and systems to ways which enable us to live well on very, very low resource use rates and environmental damage. And our simpler way position is that that is achievable. Indeed, we see the simpler way as a path to liberation. It would free us from the consumer capitalist rat race, where we all work far too hard and consume far too much, to ways which enable a very high quality of life with nothing like as much consumption. But I hasten to add that the transition is enormously big and difficult, and we do not have a good chance of achieving it. What we have to do is work very hard to try and do so.
I think that some of the people who champion our current way of life would say, well, degrowth, that sounds great, but really you're talking about billions of people dying in horrible starvation. But you're saying, no, that's not necessary. We do have ways of achieving degrowth. Is that right?
People who are accustomed in a culture that is committed to wealth, affluence, and growth, of course that's an automatic reaction that most people have. They don't want to face up to any reduction in growth and affluence. We're told that the economy must have growth to provide put people and lift people out of poverty. Well, for Pete's sake, just look at their, at our detailed explanations of how we could live well without anything like as much production, consumption, resource use. And we have quite detailed accounts of how we can do that sort of thing. So hopefully you and I can now sort of get into a bit of that detail. But firstly, let me say that there are now very rapidly growing movements around the world which are championing versions of the simpler way vision. There's the eco-village movement, there's the degrowth movement, there's the transition towns movement. Now, there's an eco-village in Missouri which is, its mission is to demonstrate how we can live very well on very low resource use rates. The quality of life, according to scientific surveys, in some of the eco-villages that have been studied, is much higher than the average in the US or Australia. And in the eco-village in Missouri, their resource use rates of electricity, water, garbage production and so on, are around 5 to 10% of the US average. Now, there's no mystery in how they do that. They live more simply, they live more cooperatively, and they have very different systems. And the key element in the different system scenario is localism. If you have highly self-sufficient, small, local economies, you can dramatically eliminate so many resource costs. We did a study of egg supply, and we compared the supermarket pass with its vast industrial global networks of fishing fleets and agribusiness and battery factory egg production, etc., supermarkets, heaps of transport, energy use, chemicals. We compared that with the energy of dollar costs of backyard and co-op production of eggs. And the multiple is a 100 or more to 1. In other words, if you produce an egg in the backyard, the total running cost and embodied capital cost of that production system is about 1% of what happens in the typical supermarket part. Now, that can be the same in all sorts of other supply chains and industries. For example, you can have a fishing industry in a normal suburban system in fish tanks. Little fish tanks are very highly productive. And one of the implications of the many benefits involved in this approach is that you do not have to produce fertilizers and you do not have to produce and maintain a sewer system, because a local food production system enables you to recycle all the nutrients from kitchens via buckets back to compost heaps and veggie gardens. Now, along with that domestic neighbourhood food production system using many permaculture principles and gardening everything you can get your hands on, like putting orchards in public parks, along with that we have little farms close by the town or neighbourhood as part of the local economy. Now, that enables you to eliminate vast amounts of production and consumption. Like, you don't need trucks to bring food from the ports to hundreds of kilometres to country towns, because most of that food can be grown in the town. And again, we have scientific studies. I've done one of my own local suburb, which finds that nearly all the food needed could actually be produced in intensive systems within the area of the town, and then out in those local farms. So there are terrific ways of doing these things, of cutting the resource demands and the ecological impact right down, and they're being practiced here and there around the world, and many terrific examples in places like disadvantaged Detroit suburbs.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Ted Trainer. Ted is the founder of The Simpler Way, and you could perhaps look for this book published in 2020, A Simpler Way, Collected Writings of Ted Trainer. That's where I sort of bit into all this. Now, I have to say, Ted, that I've seen some of this before in the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s and transition towns, as you mentioned. But honestly, those social experiments haven't really caught on so far. The masses have not followed. Have we learned from the earlier trials? And are you offering something different with The Simpler Way?
No, I don't think it's basically different. And of course, these things have not caught on. Of course, you know, culture that is obsessed with affluence and growth and is stuck with a economic and political system which must have growth or people get unemployed and dumped, that's not surprising that it hasn't shot the lights out. The critique of growth is only about 50 to 70 years old, and in the first, say, 40, 50 years of it, there were only a few pathetic little efforts to draw attention to the stupidity of growth and the availability of other ways. What is remarkable is that since about 2000, actually, it has rocketed away. It's really taken off now, and especially evident in the degrowth movement. What we think is going to happen, we have very little doubt that this society is running into a time of enormous troubles, where things are breaking down. The system is running out of resources. It's creating environmental problems that are hampering it now, like causing climate damage. It's an economic system which heaps wealth on the rich and dumps vast numbers into poverty, and people are getting cranky about that now. And it's only in the last few decades that the discontent has boiled up, generated by the fact that the system's not providing well for people, even in the richest countries. And so you get Trump, you get the discontent of vast numbers of people who are fed up with the system which won't provide for them, and blame the government and then turn to authoritarian, charismatic leaders, and it's happening in Europe too, and that is not surprising. It is not surprising that people haven't flocked to the simpler way, especially when, as I said, the image of high living standards is all we know. It's all we've been taught and practiced until now. But the tide is turning, driven largely by the discontent and also by the achievements of the alternative movements that are demonstrating these things. Let me just point quickly to what I think is the most impressive one I've ever come across, and that's the Catalan Integral Cooperative in Spain. There are thousands of people who are now creating their own social institutions and mechanisms in things like their own unemployment agencies. They get rid of unemployment by creating jobs and allocating people, their own medical centres and their own food networks, eye clinics, and all of this is done by volunteers cooperatively, and they flatly refuse to have anything to do with the market or profit motive or the state. So it's opposed to big state socialism as much as anything else. Now, that just shows what miracles can be carried out, and that's not just the only example of its kind. Now, all of that's coming on now, and I have no doubt that we are going to, within decades, be in a hell of a lot of trouble, which may be the end of us. There are many, many books now talking about the imminent collapse of Western civilization, and I think a very plausible argument that that's going to happen. All you can do is commit yourself to trying to prevent it, and the only way to do that is to help stimulate these alternative initiatives and raise awareness about the two things. One, that the current system's no good, it's got to be replaced, and B, that there is an alternative, a simpler one alternative, which actually provides for everyone, solves the big problems, and raises the quality of life. Now, my own view is very pessimistic. I think it's going to be extremely difficult, and it's unlikely that we'll make it. But if the logic of my argument is valid so far, you have no choice but to commit yourself to trying to bring it off. And the thing you have to do in that campaign is simply talk. We have to spread the ideas as far and as much as we can.
Well, I know many people feel only a collapse could wake up everybody else, but collapse keeps postponing itself for decades, creating more damage all the way. In 2016, I did a show called Can We Count on Catastrophe? But I have to say, on the other hand, I recently saw a poll showing almost half of French youth believe that we should only fly twice in a whole lifetime to limit climate emissions. So I know that many, many young people do know what's going on here. The question is, can they get enough power to get simple before collapse forces us into survival living?
Yep, it's a narrow race, isn't it, between the breakdown of things and whether we can get our team together strong enough in time. It's going to be a close thing. You cannot get people to think about these issues unless things do deteriorate. So you have to hope for a Goldilocks recession, that we go down slowly enough so that there's time for people to see the light and start moving to their local systems and co-ops and committees to pick up the responsibility for getting their own neighbourhood and town into better shape, to build the community gardens and so on. Now, it is quite conceivable that those two things will proceed at a good pace. In other words, that the breakdown will be just enough, at just enough speed to push people in the right direction. We don't want it too fast, and of course, you've got a global financial system with an astronomical amount of debt now that can never be paid, and that financial system can go down overnight. So there are reasons to think that it won't be slow and at the pace we need, but you just have to work on the hope that it will be slow enough. Now, I've been in this game for many decades, and I am staggered at the rate at which the forces for good are coming on, and so there are very strong reasons to be optimistic about what we can achieve. And whether you're optimistic or pessimistic, you've got no option, if you've got any responsibility for the world, to get into the game of trying to raise that awareness.
Some pioneers in sustainable living saw themselves making lifeboats for the big crash. They would preserve skills and knowledge of how to live locally and use resources sustainably. I'm sure you see that in your own work, do you?
Yes, but the lifeboat word is a little bit less than ideal, I think. It's pioneering. It's saving the planet the only way it can be saved. And we've got millions of heroes out there who are humble people just plodding away, trying to increase the good things, like more cooperation and participation within the neighbourhood, like building those systems of community gardens, the sharing, and the looking after little old people who are isolated and so on, dropping in on them. That work is what most needs to be done. It's not a matter of risking your life and undergoing hardship and deprivation and fighting at the barricades. And it's not a matter of trying to persuade the state to change. The state governments cannot do these things. This is a grassroots revolution. It can only be carried out by little people and groups, co-ops on the ground, pioneering, setting up the new ways, so that as time goes by, we gain more strength and we take it away from the corporations and the state, and we eventually force the state to come over and serve us rather than trying to prop up the growth economy, because at the moment that's the only way they know to try and fix the problem. So the good things are happening. They're being carried out by little people, and it's very important to get ordinary people to realise how important they are.
Well, I think that some high consumers picture what we're talking about as a huge loss as suffering, but actually, my simple years without electricity, living on the land, are the most vivid in my life. I think we need to communicate that the simpler way can be the happier way.
That's right. That's right. I'm not connected. My house hasn't been connected to the grid. I use 1% of the Australian household per capita electricity use. Produce my own water off the roof, etc., etc. I don't have a TV or a car. My quality of life is very high because I've got lots of interesting things to do, hobbies and so on. Can I tell your listeners that all of this stuff is detailed at thesimplerway.info website, thesimplerway.info, and can you, if you can, Alex, make known the video we've just made on where I live, and it's we've for about 40 years been taking visitors through, demonstrating, illustrating, introducing these sorts of ideas. I think if you just Google YouTube The Simpler Way, a visit, it's a visit to Pigface Point, people will see that. It's 48 minutes, a lot of detail. It's a little bit clunky because it's homemade, but we think it illustrates the virtues of the simpler way and the feasibility, the fact, the ways that we can easily build if we want to do it.
I will definitely pass that link on. And as we wrap up here, I know we have a wealth of expertise. Is there anything else that you want to pass on to our listeners?
The only thing I don't think we've stressed enough is that this is not a socialist vision in the common sense. People fear socialism because it implies a big centralised state. Now, the state cannot do these things, and it will not, because, as I said, it's obsessed with cranking up the economy. We have to transcend capitalism. We have to build a new economy which is highly democratic. Those local communities will have to be participatory democracies. So you have town meetings where everybody debates, discusses and decides what I'm going to do with the parking lot now that we don't need it anymore. So the correct term is really anarchism in the classical sense of participatory democracy. So I want to hit on the head the fear that what we're talking about looks like big state, totalitarian, authoritarian socialism. It's a kind of socialism, but a different kind. And the key concept is democratic, equalitarian, participatory local government by the people.
From Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with independent scholar, author, and pioneer Dr. Ted Trainer. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org, but first connect with Ted's work at www.thesimplerway.info. Ted Trainer, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. You're doing a good job there.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.